He's about 455 yards away. He's going to hit about a 2-iron, I think.
This is the School of Motion podcast. Come for the MoGraph, stay for the puns. I'm an After Effects geek at heart. That's just what I love doing. I love spending hours tweaking things and working on really elaborate setups and comps and generally just like hyper-focusing on the task of animation and nothing else. And that is why I have a very special place in my heart for those folks out there who can sit back and observe the big picture, who can manage all of the moving parts of a project like some sort of puppet master. I'm, of course, talking about producers. So if you haven't worked in a larger environment, you may never have experienced just how invaluable a good producer can be and how awful a bad producer can be. But their title, producer, it doesn't really do justice to the miracles that they're asked to perform on an almost daily basis. They're juggling the needs of clients who are paying the bills with the realities of render farms and artist availability. And a good producer is worth their weight in gold. And I am incredibly fortunate today to have an excellent producer on the podcast. Erica Hilbert is a producer at The Mill in their Chicago office. She has over a decade of experience and has also produced for Method Studios and Digital Kitchen. So she's used to working at the high end of the industry in terms of budgets, team size, and of course, talent pool. She's also a mother of three beautiful children, which I can tell you from experience does not make your job easier. And Erica and I actually met and became friends while attending the film and television program at Boston University. So she's also a great buddy of mine. In this chat with Erica, we get into what the heck a producer actually does, how they manage clients, how they hire freelancers, how they deal with the stress of last-minute changes and budgets that are too small, and all of the other fun parts of motion design. I think you'll learn a ton from this episode, at least I hope you do. And if you like this interview, head over to schoolofmotion.com where you can find other podcast episodes, articles, tons of free lessons, and information about our training programs, which have recently crossed the 2,000 alumni mark. Our students have been getting gigs at companies like Google, Troika, Giant Ant, Facebook, HBO, Netflix, you name it, a lot of amazing places. So without further ado, let's say hello to Erica Hilbert. Erica, thank you so much for taking time out of your insane producer slash mother of three schedule to talk to me about producing.
Of course. I'm happy to be here and happy to lend my my expertise and hear what you have going on over there as well.
Well, there's a lot going on over here, but let's talk about you. Let's bring it back to producing. So One of the things that kind of hit me, I think probably like 2 or 3 years into actually working, like once I graduated college and I started working, was that there was this role in the industry called producer. And it seemed to me like without them, nothing ever happened. And what's funny is I didn't have a clue what a producer was. I didn't even really know it was a thing until I started working. Like I wasn't taught about it in school. So I was wondering if you could just kind of start out for everyone in that situation. Just explain as, you know, in as much detail as you want, what the heck does a producer do?
Sure. Well, you know, it's you know, we went to the same college, obviously, together and then went kind of in somewhat different paths and then came full circle into motion graphics and design. So it's pretty cool. I think it's, you know, it's not something that I obviously studied in school. We both were in, you know, film and television. And in the film program at BU, I definitely took on more of a producer role since I started to gravitate towards that. And I think what in school, what that encompassed was sort of just wrangling everyone together and organizing the shoots, organizing the budgets, planning the schedules, making sure that everyone was where they needed to be, when they needed to be there, and taking those that skill set and that sort of mentality into the working world. I definitely kept in, you know, in the producer track when I went to go look for jobs in television, film, and commercial production. So generally speaking, I always say, or I always used to say that a producer is the liaison between, you know, the client and the artist or the client and the shop. And as I've kind of grown in my career, that's definitely still true, but it's definitely evolved into way more than just that. And I've learned to know that it's more, you know, you're the representative of the artist and of the shop or the co-op that you're working for, and you're helping to sell whatever creative product it is that your artists are coming up for, with for your client. So, you know, generally speaking, it is just, you know, you take on the role of, you know, being the liaison, but you also take on the role of being the, you know, punctuating what the creatives and what the artists are trying to do for the client, keeping everyone on schedule within budget, and working with the client on, you know, getting feedback to your team and getting feedback from your team back to the client, why we think a certain thing works better than another, offering up creative solutions, financial solutions, and, you know, things within the schedule as well, but also, you know, just being that advocate for your artist. That's what I think producing is in a nutshell. It depends on, you know, what type of shop you're at and what specific field you're in. For, you know, motion graphics or design and visual effects, which I'm in now, it is a lot, you know, being the advocate for your artists and for your company, and being the representative and going out there and presenting the best product to your client. But then also, you know, keeping the artists and your team in check as making sure they're hitting those bullet points in the original creative brief and making sure they're hitting the original request from the client and not just going off and doing whatever they want.
Got it. Okay. So I want to talk a lot about each of those little pieces, but, you know, I want to ask kind of a devil's advocate question here. So, you know, why do we need a producer to do those things? Like, why can't the, you know, the 3D artist who is actually kind of leading, like a 3D lead or something, why can't they be the one talking to the client, since they're the ones that have the most knowledge about how long things are going to take to render and how hard changes are going to be and all those kinds of things? Why doesn't the artist just deal directly with the client? Why do you want a producer kind of in the middle there?
I think, you know, you sort of explained it just by asking the question. It's the artist, to keep them in their, you know, focused on what they're meant to do, and is just to create and be an artist and not be bogged down with the financials and the sort of nitty gritty of the job. It's just acting as a buffer so that, and the artist definitely talk to the client. You know, when we have reviews or we have discussions with the client, I have my creative leads on the phone and they're leading the conversation. And if anything, the producer is just there just to, like I said, continue to punctuate what the creative has said, back them up, and then also make sure that what the creative is proposing is within schedule and budget. It's the creative and the artist's, you know, job to sort of help the client think outside the box. And it's the producer to make sure that everything that was in the original box is also being accounted for. I've always only worked in situations where there's been an artist and a producer relationship. And I have many freelancer friends who have also, you know, asked for producer advice and how to handle communicating a certain thing with the client. And sometimes it's just hard for an artist to try to convey what they really want to do or what they want to get across to the client without, having to, you know, jeopardize their relationship or jeopardize the creative that they're trying to propose. I think it's important to have that buffer only because you're, as a true artist, you want to just focus on what, you know, you're there to do your job. They hired you to, create something really cool for their, you know, for their client or for the product. I think it's imperative that the artist focuses on that and that only, and that the producer is able to shield them from the minutia of financials and schedule. And, you know, the artist always has an idea of what the budget and the schedule is, but their main focus should be on just, you know, creating the art and creating, you know, the end result for the client.
Cool. So I remember when I was running a studio in Boston, and I was creative director, I was also lead animator, and there were a lot of calls I was on with my producer there, where my producer, who was amazing, she it was almost like she would jump in front of bullets and catch them for me, because a client would say something that was going to infuriate me, because
exactly.
The person who stayed up all night animating that shot and then they changed their mind and now they want something totally different but they don't want to pay more, I want to explode. And it's nice to have that level-headed person there to kind of like take the hit, you know, and deal with it.
Take the hit, but then also try to smooth things out. And that's where the producer role really comes into play is maybe the request that the client had based on your latest, you know, render or posting is absolutely ridiculous or absolutely not necessary. The producer has the opportunity there then to discuss with the client, you know, is this absolutely necessary? Do you really want this change before I go back to my team and request this of them? Is this on brand? Is this on point? You know, and try to, like you said, shield you from that request before it even gets to you. So as a freelancer without a producer working with them, they tend to then, you know, have to just say yes, or the job goes away, or they, you know, they become a, or there's like, you know, the roadblock is you either say yes to the request or you say no and potentially harm the relationship that you have with that client. Whereas a producer can, you know, can kind of have this like creative little dance with the client and say, well, that sounds, you know, we hear your request, but here's what we may offer up instead of that. Or here's why we think that might not be a great idea. And the producer can also go back to the artist and say, the client's asking for this, but we can push back. Help me get the point across to the client why we shouldn't do that or why that's a bad request or a bad idea. Whereas a freelancer has to kind of think on their toes and respond to the client, you know, somewhat immediately, I'm sure, to their request. And that kind of takes them out of that whole artist role.
That's a huge point. So I've seen producers do that kind of like, it's like verbal jujitsu where you're saying no without saying no.
Yeah.
And it takes a lot of practice. So like, are there any, I don't know, like strategies or tips or anything like that that you've kind of developed over the years for like how you can kind of get out of that situation when you're on the phone call and the client says, so Erica, we really want to take this shot and do it completely differently. Can you guys do that? And in your head, you're like, we can, it's just going to take an extra week and, you know, an extra giant check from you. What would you say to them to avoid being stuck in that situation where you have to say yes or the job goes away?
So the good thing about being a producer is the client tends to it depends. You know, if the client leans on the producer as a lot on a certain project, they start to earn, you know, the trust. So the producer has sort of like the gravitas to tell the client, you know, no in a certain way, because the producer is starting to trust, you know, the client's starting to trust that producer, because they know what they're talking about. The way that a producer gets to that point is by really just communicating back and forth with the artist, and, you know, truly understanding what it takes to do the job and to do the project, so that the producer can speak, you know, can speak to the client with sort of experience or at least with knowledge of what it entails to do the job. That way, when a client goes to a producer and asks, you know, can you redo this render? The producer knows that the render is going to take 10 to 12 hours and it's absolutely not necessary to really do it because you could maybe adjust it in comp or something and you know, a different way to do it. So offering up those solutions to the client, but being able to speak knowledgeably about a project will make the client, I think, feel at ease that the producer knows what they're talking about and can then take no for an answer from them. The artists can tend to do this as well. I mean, sometimes the client wants to speak directly with an artist regarding a certain request that maybe the producer is pushing back on. And in which case, that's sort of when you pull in the artist and prep them for it, but then also stand behind what they have to say. So you're not just a yes man for the client.
That's awesome advice. One of the tricks we used to do is we would never agree to anything on the phone. We would always say something vague like, oh yeah, no, we'll have to just get together and talk about that and we'll get back to you. Like never commit on the phone, even though there's all this pressure to like just say, oh yeah, we just need to like talk internally about that. And it gives you a chance to come up with an excuse not to do it.
Yeah. And that's producer 101. And unfortunately, I don't think as like a young, you know, producer or associate producer or coordinator in the business, you don't really have the confidence or feel like you can say that because, you tend to just say yes or yes, we can definitely do that or we'll look into it for you, whatever. It comes with experience and it comes, you know, building up that confidence and also, you know, building up that relationship with your artists and your team. So making sure that you understand you're there to work for them. I mean, the client hired you or your company for a certain reason. It wasn't for you just to say yes and execute their boards. It was for you to take their creative idea, interpret it, and come up with something even cooler than they originally thought of. So that comes with time. I think I had, you know, the the luxury or the fortunate opportunity to work for a great company right out of school, starting my career. So I got a lot of good experience with a lot of senior type of people right away. So I think that really helped. But for someone that's possibly coming out of school and just, you know, getting into production, a way to just build up that confidence and build up that knowledge, just to constantly be asking questions and sort of, you know, humbling yourself and talking to your artist and saying, you know, I don't really understand what this means. Or I don't really understand what, you know, what render is or what's, you know, what, whatever, question the client has, can you help me explain this to them? And as long as it's coming out of the producer's mouth, not the artist's mouth, then the client will say, well, this person really knows what they're talking about. I trust them. So yes, forget about that silly request I asked, or don't make your team stay late. We can post this in the morning. You know, it all just comes with experience and building up that confidence on how to talk to people.
Gotcha. So that brings up an interesting point when you're talking about asking the artist about, well, hey, what does rendering mean and stuff like that. To be a producer in the visual effects or motion design industry, do you feel like you have to have a certain amount of like good taste? Do you need to be able to tell good design from bad? Do you even need to understand like a little bit about 3D and rendering and After Effects? Like how much of that knowledge do you have to have as a producer to be effective?
You know, not as much knowledge as the actual artist that's doing it, but close to it. You really need to have an understanding of what your artists are doing. And you definitely need to have a good eye for, you know, good design, good comp, good visual effects. I think that's what really separates good producers from not so great producers, or not so great producers, but producers that are definitely more heavily involved in the actual craft and can speak to the client in terms of like, you know, creative speak and give their creative opinion. I think that lends itself more to that your client trusting you even more because you not only are saying, yes, that's within schedule and budget, but you're also telling them this actually might not work for your brand or your product or give, you know, creative opinion that maybe your artist can definitely back you up on as well. I think it's great when a producer has creative opinions on projects. Again, I'm always talking to the artist and talking to my team about different scenarios, different solutions to come up with. I always offer up my ideas, even if they seem, you know, silly or maybe not even possible, but at least it shows that, you know, I'm trying to help them think outside the box, not trying to micromanage them, but just try to help them come up with some other creative solutions that maybe they're not seeing because they don't have the information that you have as a producer. You know, we kind of can play devil's advocate on our end as well and kind of say, well, I think the client is when the client's requesting the color blue, I think they're actually requesting the color blue, not pink. Like you keep pushing. So it's a good way. I think it's great for the producers to weigh in creatively. And a way to do that is to have knowledge of the craft, you know, to have, to know not only the terminology and how the process works, but also what looks good, what doesn't look good. And that's all subjective. You know, the thing that I always remind younger producers is that we are in the business of subjectivity. It's what looks good and what doesn't look good. There's no really right or wrong, which makes our job really, really fun, but also makes it really, really hard. I think, like I said, I think if a producer can weigh in creatively and have knowledge of the process, that's only going to help you and help your team. You know, you'll be able to speak knowledgeably about the subject and about the product that you're trying to sell. And the client's just going to earn your trust even more. And your creative team will earn your trust as well. I think it's, you know, there's multiple personalities in this business, in this industry. And you really, as a producer, need to know how to walk and talk with different people and different personalities and work with different people in different ways. So you really need to be this sort of chameleon and wear multiple hats and just know as much as you can so that you can help in as many ways as possible.
That's awesome. So can you talk about just for a little bit, like the mill is, I believe, probably one of the biggest, it's about as big as a motion design studio can be. I mean, you know, multiple offices, hundreds of staff. And so where does the producer fit in? Cause when you were just talking, I was thinking about, you know, it must be kind of a tightrope act at sometimes to like give your opinion and almost act as like the gatekeeper between the artist and the art director. And where does the producer fit in terms of, you know, you've got the artist, you've got the producer, you've got the art director, you may have a creative director, you may have a senior creative director. you know, where do you step in and sort of act as the gatekeeper between those, I guess, approval steps, you know?
I think the key thing to remember is you're not stepping in at certain points, but you're constantly involved throughout the whole process. You know, internally, you have your reviews between your actual team and the creative director on that job, and potentially, you know, your senior creative director, creative director of the office, or the 2D lead or 3D lead. So you have internal check-ins that the producer needs to make sure that the team is aware of. So you're involved internally from the beginning of the job throughout. And yeah, you go back to your desk and your team continues to work, so you're not sitting over their shoulder the whole time. But the key is to not feel like you need to be stepping in at certain points, but just constantly involved. And it's something that happens, you know, kind of organically. You go and check in with your team. You say, hey, let's have the creative director check this, or let's have our 3D lead check this before we show it to the client. And then behind the scenes, you're always talking to the client and getting feedback from them, updates on the schedule changes. And so that's stuff that happens behind the scenes that the artist doesn't even see. And then you go back to your artist and check in with them later in the day and say, hey, now it's time to post for the client. Here's some updates, though. You know, the schedule changed. So what do you guys think we need to do to accommodate this? Do we need to throw more resources on it? Do we need to work maybe one late night? Let's try to, you know, make it happen without sort of, you know, busting our butts on this job and staying within the scope and budget and schedule. Then you post for your client, you get on the call, you get feedback, send it back to the team, you check in with the team, make sure they're addressing all those notes. So you're always in the job and you're always in, you know, involved in the project. You don't step in and step out. One other thing is, you know, you have multiple jobs. So you have multiple teams that you're managing sometimes, especially, you know, at a company like The Mill, where you could be managing, you know, 2, 3, 4, five jobs at a time. So you're always in the know, and you're always, you know, you should always know what's going on with your jobs. You shouldn't just feel like, all right, here's my time to step in now, or now I need to step in and figure this out for the team. It's a constant process.
Gotcha.
If that makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah, no, that does make a lot of sense. So, I mean, once the job is happening, you're essentially like the traffic cop, you know, in a sense,
yeah.
And you're funneling things, making sure everything's going. But let's talk about before the job begins, because I think that's a part of the process that a lot of artists are, especially freelance artists who are starting out, really curious about. Like, some client calls The Mill and they say, we need a commercial for this. How, like, what's the process of figuring out how much that costs?
Your artists are definitely involved in that process as well, because when a job first comes in or the brief first lands on a producer's desk, you do a call, initial call with maybe the agency producer. And then ideally your creative team can get on the phone with the agency's creative team or the client's creative team, and they can sort of walk us through what the creative brief is. So you hear it firsthand, and it's not a game of telephone. You review the boards. You go back with your team, you review the boards, and then you start to put together, you know, a schedule and how long the job will take, what resources it'll take, and you plug all that into a bid. A lot of places that I've worked at, almost every place that I've worked at, you've never just gone back to your desk and done a bid on your own. You've always had to rope in an artist or multiple artists and get accurate counts. This allows for two things. This allows for your bid to be, you know, as accurate as possible, but also allows some accountability for the creative team. If your creative team is telling you it's going to take 3 weeks to do a job, and, you know, you're coming down to the second week and they're like, we don't have enough time, we needed 6 weeks on this job, you could say, well, you saw the original boards, you were on the original calls with the creatives, and you bid this out with me. So, you know, it also helps the creatives, the artists, learn how long things actually take, and can give them some accountability on the project. So they really have some ownership. It doesn't all fall on the producer.
Gotcha. That makes a ton of sense. Let me ask you real quick, Erica. So you mentioned boards. Now, at what point in the process are these boards being created? And are you talking about boards created by designers at The Mill? So if a client says we need, you know, I don't know, we need a spot for a car commercial, how much is this going to cost? And you have that creative call with the agency, with the client. Does The Mill then create boards and then present those and say, these boards that we've created for free for you, if you want to produce spot, will cost X amount of dollars? Or is the client paying for that process too?
That is the million-dollar question. You know, so an agency will call us and they'll have their agency boards, right? They're generally just, you know, illustrated cartoon boards. Sometimes they have some imagery, some stock imagery. Then we in turn would take those boards and put, you know, if we're going to pitch on the job, then we'll go back and create a pitch team and put together our, you know, our interpretation of those boards and, you know, sort of heighten the creative level of them. So we will, yes, then we'll create our own storyboards or a pitch presentation. We have every company I've worked at has put together always, you know, really nice presentation decks where we take the agency original boards, their original kernel of an idea, and just like transform it into, you know, what we would want to create for this brand or for this product. That can be a process of a day or two. We need to quickly put together a style frame just to wow them and win this job, or a week or two where we can actually dedicate a team of designers to put together some storyboards, some style frames, some concept frames, and really put together a nice treatment and presentation for them. Whether the client pays for it, it just all dependent on the job and the budget. Generally speaking, this is an investment point of investment for a company where we may be pitching against two or three other, you know, visual effects post-production companies. So we see it as an investment. We will invest the time and the money and the artists to put together this nice deck to win the job, because then, you know, the budget for actually doing the job is, you know, generally pretty good. So you put the time in during the pitch phase to win the job. Rarely do we get pitch funds for projects that we're pitching on. We do sometimes, and it's great. But generally speaking, it's usually an investment on the company's end.
Gotcha. And I'm just curious, how do you feel, what's the general sense about pitching at the mill? Because this is a big, really big controversial topic in our industry. There was a really good panel on it at the last Blend conference. And, you know, you had Tendril and Buck and Giant Ant, who all had very different opinions about pitching. I'm curious, what's the mill's position? What's Erica's position on pitching?
You know, usually when a job comes in, you have an idea of what the scope of the project is or what the budget will be. So that will really warrant how many resources you put towards a pitch. If it's a job, you know, $500,000 to a $600,000 job, you're going to try to win that by putting as many resources as you can on it. Sometimes it just takes one style frame to win a job. Sometimes it takes a whole, you know, 30-page presentation with, character design and a written treatment and a whole section about cinematography. The good thing about the mill is we've got, you know, we get jobs of all different kinds. We'll get pure design jobs. We'll get live action with visual effects jobs. We'll get purely CG jobs. So generally speaking, the jobs that need pitches are mostly just the jobs that we're going to do from start to finish, or like what we call, we have a Mill Plus, and Mill Plus handles jobs from basically start to finish. So we will, you know, we'll pitch on the shoot. We have a roster of directors that we, that will put up for the job. They'll put together a really nice treatment, and the designer will hop on and do some frames for them. Then Mill Plus also will do, you know, complete design jobs from start to finish. I'm working on a job right now for an agency in Atlanta where it's all design. And so we come up with style frames to try to win the job. They, you know, they bought it, gave us the job, and we took those style frames. And the investment there was we literally took those style frames and we put them into motion. So some of the legwork was already done. I think the mill generally wants to pitch on jobs. Our artists, enjoy putting together the presentations, and it's an opportunity for us to get in from the ground up on the creative approach for a project. So I think any company would be silly to not want to be involved at that point and try to win the job and pitch on something and pitch their idea. That's the opportunity when, you know, you get to really speak your mind creatively and say, here's what we're proposing for this product or for this, you know, for this brand. The controversy, I think, comes from the fact that you're not the only company obviously pitching on this job. There could be, you know, usually three, maybe four or five other companies pitching on it, and you're not getting paid for it. And they may take your creative idea and maybe produce it without even hiring you, you know, on for the job. So I understand where the controversy is coming from, but that's the business, and that's, you know, it's the competitiveness of it. And I think that's where this sort of, you know, like I said, you can speak your mind and try to drive the creative during a pitch. So that's, I think, priceless and a priceless opportunity to have.
That's a really interesting way of looking at it. And I agree with you. I think it is
that's
just
my opinion. I'm not sure if it's Bill's opinion.
But sure. Yes. We'll have a little disclaimer. This is not, this does not represent the Mill's official opinion, but I think it's true that, you know, love it or hate it, it's reality. It's just kind of the way the business works. And there are studios that don't really pitch. And that works for them. But I'm curious if you think not pitching, because it seems to me, in my limited experience running a studio, pitches happen more at the higher end once you get those big budgets, right? Like, you know, my studio, a huge budget would be 150 grand. That would probably be the biggest one we've ever done. You just casually threw out $600,000, you know, as a budget. So like, right. So, at that scale, you have to pitch, right? And so do you think that not pitching would sort of limit the size and the growth a studio could have?
I don't think so. I know a lot of freelancers who work on their own or in smaller co-op style studios that will put together, you know, amazing style frames or like, you know, 8 to 10 storyboard frames to win a job that's potentially, you know, only $15,000-$20,000. I think anything you do to pitch is an investment in if you do win the job, then that's, you know, sort of the heavy lifting done. The creative idea is there and you just need to execute at that point. So I don't think it's a matter of, you know, stifling growth if you don't pitch, but I think it's a matter of stifling the, you know, your creative art form if you don't pitch, because you don't give your artists the opportunity to kind of come up with this idea and really come up with the initial concepting. I think a lot of that, you know, as an artist, you want to, you know, be the original concepter and have the original sort of ownership of an idea. So I think it's just better for any studio to just be in on that process instead of just taking an agency's board and just executing it at that point.
Yeah, I think a few years ago, you said something to me that kind of really stuck with me. You said that, and I'm probably going to get it wrong, but you said something that was basically, you don't win a client when you deliver a really good finished piece. You win a client when you show them the boards for the first time and you get them really excited. And I think that's really good advice. I mean, from what you're saying, it sounds like if you win the pitch, then the job is essentially done and now you just have to like make it, right? I mean, I'm sure the artists don't feel that way.
They don't. This job I just mentioned, where it was a purely design job that we pitched and won. I've got an awesome team on it, and they did a great pitch. The client just, you know, loved it from the beginning. So we won the job. That enough should give, you know, the team and, you know, everyone, myself, enough confidence to say we know what we're doing, and the client hired us for a reason. So that should give you that as much, you know, confidence to go through and continue to sell the initial motion tests and, you know, any other little cool ideas that you think, you know, might push the project to be even cooler throughout the process. And it totally has. You know, we've been presenting some really cool animations, and the client's just been signing off left and right on things. And their feedback has been, you know, yep, liking it, continue, because we put so much into the original pitch and the style frames that they knew what they were going to get. There hasn't been any sort of like crazy left turns or surprises for them. So it's been a pretty smooth process. Now, you know, that's, I think, usually how a job goes, but there's always those one or two anomalies where they just completely throw you for a curveball and you change totally, you know, you do a creative left turn on what you originally pitched on. And at that point, it could be a little frustrating for your team, or a lot frustrating, because what they originally thought they were going to do is, you know, thrown out the window and they're doing something completely different. I'm working on another job currently that's, you know, similar to that, where we came up with some really cool ideas. They signed off on them. And in the end, what we ended up producing was a totally simplified, watered down version of what we originally pitched. So it goes both ways. You know, sometimes it goes really well and the client, you know, literally falls in love with you at pitch phase. Sometimes it's, you know, a little more down the road, and sometimes there's never that love to begin with.
Right. You just, one for the meal, one for the reel. So, So when you're in that situation, I mean, so the situation you just described is kind of the opposite situation, where you sell them on a really complicated, cool idea, and in the end, it's this watered down kind of milquetoast version. But what happens when it goes the other way and all of a sudden clients start asking for more and more and more and more? How do you talk to them when they're asking for something that's going to cost more money and you know that they don't want to spend more money?
Right. So this is the fork in the road. And as a producer, you kind of need to be overly communicative with your team and with your client in terms of what's possible and what's not. I feel like you can go like sort of, there's so many different routes you could take, but the two main routes are, you take one for the team and you agree that what they're asking for is definitely going to make the project, you know, or the job go in an even cooler, better way. And you invest in that and knowing that the client does not have the money to put towards, you know, an overage or to give you additional funds for it. But your team agrees and the client agrees and everyone's on board. So you just do it because at the end of the day, you want to, you know, make an awesome, stellar spot. The other route is you have to push back because the requests that they're making, you know, are out of scope and potentially not even necessary, or maybe the agency completely just changed their idea and it's a completely different creative solution or creative request. In which case, as a producer, you really need to kind of explain that to your client and hit them up with an overage or, you know, let them know how much additional resources and time it's going to take. And again, it's just by communicating, you know, I always go back to the client and say, well, you know, we agree that's going to be a cool, you know, that's a cool request and we'd love to do that for you, but we just don't have the resources or, you know, our job is scheduled until this week and you're asking for 2-3 more weeks of work. Here's how much that'll cost. Just giving them the amount and letting them know, you know, that they need to either pay up or B, you're taking this on and you're investing this much into the job. What that does is, you know, the general idea is that shows that you're investing in the project and you're going above and beyond for the client and hopefully they'll come back to you for more work. Does that happen? Sometimes they say, you know, we know you guys fell on the sword on this job and we're going to bring you back our next campaign. Sometimes you don't hear from them for years. But I think it's just about communication with your client, communication with your team about what's absolutely necessary and possible, what it'll take to actually do the work and communicating that, those thoughts to everybody across the board. So everyone knows and everyone's on board. If you say yes to your client before going to your team and your team says, well, that's going to take 3 weeks of, you know, super late nights, why would you commit to that? That puts you in a bad position with your team. If you go back to your client and say, no, we can't do this and just stand your ground, that puts you in a bad position with your client. So you really need to kind of find that soft spot, that middle ground where you guys are all in agreement on what you're taking on.
I love the way you put it too. One of the things that I've kind of learned from watching good producers is that you typically never lead with, well, that's going to cost more money. You would
right.
say, you would say that's going to take more resources. That's going to take more time, which costs money. It kind of like, for some reason, just putting it that way kind of softens the blow a little bit.
Yeah. Totally. And they know, I mean, they know when the second they ask you to, you know, turn this car red from red to blue, that it's going to take days and time and money. But they're, you know, that's not their job to care about that. Their job is to ask you for what their client wants, manage their client too, but, you know, ask you for what the client wants. And it's our job to let them know, you know, what's possible within the time of the original schedule of job and original budget. And if it goes above and beyond that, letting them know that in the most sort of, you know, you don't want to just make it all about money because maybe the car is better off blue than red. And so maybe you do agree with their crazy request. It's going to take you, you know, 3 weeks of late nights. But as long as everyone's on board, I think it makes it for a much more smooth process.
Yeah. And that's actually kind of profound what you just said, which is something that it took me years to realize, which was it's not their job to care about the money. It's their job to ask you to do it to see if you will. Like I've worked with a lot of ad agencies where that's the culture is, well, just ask your vendor if they'll do it. They may say no, but ask. And so you get asked these crazy requests that they really don't expect you to say yes to. And so if you come at it from that perspective, you don't get as offended, especially if you're a freelancer where you're producing and doing the work. It's a lot nicer to kind of think of it that way. So do you have any sort of producer tricks that you use to help mitigate stuff like this, like padding budgets, padding deadlines, like not sending approval emails till the end of the day when you know they're more likely to approve it? Like, what are some of the things like that you do to try and like smooth out the bumpy road?
it kind of goes back to what I said originally. It was, you have to know how to work with so many different people in different ways. If I know a certain client is just waiting by their computer, waiting for a posting to get to review it and give us feedback right away, there's no point in sandbagging it. If we said, hey, we're going to post this at 3 o'clock and shocker, my designer is overestimated and now it's posted by 10 a.m. I'm going to send it to the client and say, you know, oh, it actually took us a lot less time than we originally thought, but we wanted to get it in front of you as quickly as possible to get feedback so we can use this extra time to address anything you might need done. So that does two things. That gives your artist time for the, you know, to revise anything that needs to be revised. And it also shows your client that, you know, you're considering them and you're kind of letting them in on the process a little bit. And maybe you originally quoted, you know, 8 hours of render time, but it only took two, then great. You know, we're in this crazy technological field where sometimes things take 10 hours, sometimes they take 10 minutes. You just sometimes don't know until you actually do it. Sometimes, you know, a client's not going to get you feedback until the end of the day and then, you know, request crazy amount of changes. So if you don't want your team to be staying late, then maybe you'll say, hey, we'll post this for you first thing tomorrow morning, when you know that they can probably post it by the end of the day. But if you post at the end of the day, you're going to get feedback at 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock at night, in which case your client could potentially be expecting you to do that feedback that night. Whereas if you post it in the morning, then you can say, oh, we checked our renders this morning. Here's the posting. Let us know if you have any feedback. Then you have the rest of the day to address that feedback. And so you need to really know your client, and you really need to know what the, you know, what the project entails in terms of, you know, revisions and render time and all that, so that you can play your cards. Another big thing that I always try to do is, stay in touch with your client. If your client's emailing you, checking in, the best thing to do is just reply back right away, just so they know that you're being attentive, and say, you know, let me check in with the team and I'll get back to you, in a little bit here. Or I'll say, like, you know, we should have a posting shortly, instead of saying, we'll have a posting by 3 o'clock. We'll have a posting by 4, because you're never going to have a posting at 3 o'clock. It's always going to be 3:30 or 4:15. And then that way, you know, you're at least, giving yourself some pad. In terms of padding budgets and schedules from the initial get-go, you know, I think that's always smart. But with the way that budgets and schedules are these days, there's hardly any room to pad. Like I said, I always quote jobs with my artists. So if, you know, you get to know an artist, if an artist is quoting you 10 to 15 days of modeling, you really know it's going to take 8, or you know that that artist always overcompensates or maybe underestimates the amount of time it takes to do something. That's where, you know, again, just experience with working with different people kind of helps you in that initial, you know, bidding and padding the schedule and budget, so that you know, okay, this artist really said 5 days, but I know him and it's going to take 8 days. So I'm going to pad the bid a bit. Same with the schedule. You know, I know that he said it'll take, you know, 10 or 12 hours to render, but we have a lot of big jobs in house right now. So the render farm might be a little bit slow. So I'm going to pad some time there. Just always knowing what is going on at all times so that you can forecast, you know, everything, and put yourself in a good position.
Gotcha. So you've mentioned a couple times, like, the possibility that if, you know, if a client makes a last minute revision or something, the artist may have to stay overnight or something like that. What's the environment like at the mill in terms of, you know, expecting artists to work, you know, late and do overnights and things like that? Is it rare? Is it seen as sort of a rite of passage, or is it something that you try to avoid at all costs?
It's definitely something that we try to avoid at all costs. The mill has been one of the places that I've worked at that has an amazing work-life balance, or that really strives to achieve work-life balance for not only producers, but for artists. I think everyone has the intention of protecting their teams. That's from, you know, the producers to the creative leads, the department heads. No one wants their artists to get burnt out. With that though, there's the understanding that sometimes it takes certain things to get a job done, and that could potentially mean, you know, weekend work or late nights. It's not something that we plan for or schedule unless the client says, hey, we need this job done by Monday, so you're going to have to work the weekend. Then that's when we plan for it and schedule it from the beginning and let the team know up front, so there's no real, like, surprises. Do people work late and work weekends? Yes. And it happens, you know, you know, probably more than it should. But a lot of that, I think, is compensated with, you know, giving them days off to make up for that time that they did work late or work a weekend. I think the mill and other companies, a lot of other companies are getting really good at that, recompensating their artists for having to work late or on the weekend by giving them, you know, a day or two off at the end of the job or, you know, a few weeks later when they can free up. I've been as like a working mom and, you know, I've been able to find that work-life balance really well. I think a lot of that has to do with just really managing your time well, managing client expectations well, and being able to just be overly communicative with your client, with your team on what's realistic. I've always said to people, and this comes with experience, if your client's asking you to post something, you know, that night or get a delivery out by 5 o'clock and you know that it's going to go until 8 or 9, you can always ask. It's just like, just how they ask for your ridiculous request. You can go back and ask them, can this go out tomorrow morning? Do I need to keep my team here late? And when you're asking that, they know why you're asking that. So it kind of puts it back on them. You know, this isn't absolutely necessary. So don't keep your team there late. Do it tomorrow morning. That's fine. So it's just all about communicating so that you guys know, you know, what's actually needed and what's not needed so that you can plan and schedule your team as best as you can.
That's really good advice. So I have a kind of a tangent question here. So, you know, a producer's job is to manage other people's time to some extent. And then on top of that, you're a mother of three and you've got family and friends and things you like to do. So then you've got your personal time. And I'm asking this as someone who has in the past been really awful at managing his time. What do you do to manage your time? And I don't just mean at the mill. I mean, how do you balance that with, you know, you have to like pick your kids up and you've got doctor's appointment. Like, what I'm asking is, like, do you have a little day planner? Do you use some sort of software that tells you what you're supposed to be doing? Like, how do you manage it?
I have a fully stocked bar at work and at home at all times. No, I'm kidding.
Drink heavily.
everyone's always asking me that. And I really am trying to, you know, continue with the work-life balance. Some days, some weeks it's really, really easy. Some weeks it's really, really hard. But I think the biggest thing is just having support from work and at home. Like I mentioned earlier, the mill's really huge on work-life balance. And when I went back after having my third kid, I sat down with, you know, some my lead artists, my boss and HR, and just explained, you know, I love working here and I'll be 100% committed. But, you know, my first priority is my family and my home. So I need to make sure that I have, you know, I get home at a decent hour to put my kids, get them dinner, put them to bed, help husband with, you know, the duties at home, and see my family. And sometimes I get home at 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock, and I put the kids to sleep and then I get back on email till, you know, 10, 11, 12 at night, catching up on things. So I think that I've been warranted that opportunity because I have proven that I don't drop the ball. I don't leave anyone in the dark on what needs to get done. You just constantly communicate throughout the day and you delegate. You delegate what needs to get done to certain people. You make sure that your artists know what needs to get done. And they've actually been really good. They know that I usually, you know, leave work around 5 or 6 and they'll check in with me at like 4 or 4:30 and say, hey, do you want to come check this out before you head out? Or, hey, you're leaving soon. I'll have this render for you by 7, you know, just keep an eye out on your email. So I think it's definitely a team effort. It's been huge at the mill to be able to work with these awesome artists and to have them really respect your time as, you know, as a mom and as a producer and as a wife, and know that they trust you and they know that you're going to be online later tonight, checking out their renders, making sure they look good if you're not in the office physically with them. And they also know that, you know, I respect them. If they need to be off a day and go see their kids' concert or have a dentist appointment, I'll work postings around their schedules. So it's just about communicating and earning their trust and knowing that you're not going to drop the ball. They're not going to drop the ball and everyone's got each other's backs. So at the end of the day, we all have, you know, lives outside of work. The big problem is our work is just more than work. You know, we are in this industry because we love what we do and we're very fortunate to kind of be in this creative atmosphere. So sometimes you do want to spend a late night at work because you really want to get, do a good job on something. You really want to get something out, or you really want to be with the team and see that project through the end. So there are some late nights, and sometimes I'm there till, you know, 8, 9, or 10, but I've got a huge support system on the other end as well with my family and my husband, and being close to home really helps. So it's just both, you know, having support on both ends so that you aren't, burning the, you know, what's that saying? Burning the candle
of both ends. Yeah. That really like resonated with me. Like, cause there's times when I'm working really late and I realize like I'm doing it to myself cause I want to.
Yeah.
Which is interesting. And that's interesting conversations with your significant other sometimes. And they're like, why are you still working on this?
I know.
I can't help it.
I know.
It.
Yeah. But you know, like John's job, it's, you know, he's a fireman. So he knows what his hours are. He leaves at 6 a.m. and he's home by, you know, the next morning. And that's it. And then he doesn't have to check emails the next day. He doesn't have to like get a call last minute that he has to come in. So I think it's hard sometimes for people to understand that, you know, we are sort of committed to this job 24/7, 7 days a week. Sometimes something's up on the weekend. And sometimes I choose to ignore the email until Monday if I know that it's not necessary to reply. But sometimes you have that kind of inkling that I should reply to this client and let them know what the deal is, because I know it'll go a long way and it'll take me 2 seconds to reply an email on Saturday morning.
Right, right. That makes a ton of sense. So, all right. So you've produced for some really great places, Digital Kitchen and Method, and now The Mill. So how is producing for The Mill, which is, you know, a really big company that does everything, live action, visual effects, design, animation, how is that different than some of the other places you've produced?
I feel like it's just different because it's just on a grander scale. I have been very fortunate to work at awesome shops and big companies, small companies. Every company that I've worked at, I feel like focused in on a certain thing and gotten really great experience. At Digital Kitchen, you know, I was there during the height of like design and motion graphics, main title sequences. So I really got to get a good leg in on design work and managing that type of project. There was a small company that I worked at between there and Method, which I learned how to like, I totally sharpened my tools and live action skills and shooting. Method was sort of my first step into visual effects and CG. So I got to really learn that and experience some really cool projects while there. And then at Mill, I kind of got to put everything together, everything that I learned at all the different places, and kind of have a bit of experience in all of it. And I get to work in all those types of jobs. I go on shoots. I work on purely design jobs. I work with CG. I work with live action integrated with visual effects. And I get to kind of use all my expertise from the different companies at The Mill. And the level of creative, you know, work that we do there is just something that I'm super proud of, and I'm really glad that I've gotten to this point in my career.
So as someone, and I'm making an assumption here, but, you know, you and I, we both went to Boston University. We were in the film and television program. And I'm sure, like, at the time, we were both thinking, oh, we're going to make films. We're going to be directors. Right? That's what everybody wants to do. And now we're both doing very different things than we thought we'd be doing. And I'm just curious, like, do you feel like you get to scratch that creative itch as a producer?
Yeah. You know, I obviously did a lot of editing at BU as well. And as soon as I got out of college, I was editing freelance in the city. And then when I interviewed at Digital Kitchen, I actually got offered an assistant editor position or an assistant producer position. And I actually ended up taking the assistant producer position. At the time, I think my logic was, I think I'll be able to, as a female and as, you know, someone who wants a family and someone who wants, you know, some sort of work-life balance, I think this will be the better route for me to take. And that's really kind of funny that I thought about that at such a young age. And having, you know, sort of that, and I still edited, I still, you know, did editing on the side. I did a lot of editorial work for non-for-profits. Obviously I did the wedding business for a while. So I still got to kind of have that creative outlet. But production, going into producing was definitely a good choice for me. And I also took with me sort of that creative, like I said, the creative opinion that I like to weigh in on stuff. At each company, it was completely welcomed at each company that I was at. So I definitely feel like it satisfies sort of that creative itch in me still, because I am part of that creative process. And involved with the teams on jobs throughout, you know, throughout the whole thing.
Yeah, you brought up an interesting point. So I've always noticed, and I feel like it is shifting a little bit, but there's still a lot more female producers than males. And I'm curious if you have any thoughts on why that might be, and is that a good or bad thing?
I've noticed that too. And actually being at the mill, I've noticed it actually kind of shift. There's definitely a lot more male producers. There's definitely a lot more, producers that are really, really good, and producers that are sort of like head of productions and sort of running production departments. So seeing that kind of shift is really nice and sort of refreshing. I think, generally speaking, you see more women as producers, because it's sort of like the teachers and the nurses. It's just this kind of like sensitive motherly role that you sometimes have to take to, you know, coddle these little artists that can be such little babies at times. I don't know if it sounds sexist or not, but I think it's the same thing with teachers and nurses. It's just kind of this nurturing type of mentality that kind of warrants being a good producer. So men have that too. And I always think like, you know, man, we need more male teachers and male nurses. And when you actually see a male teacher or male nurse, they're kind of like a, you know, a pink elephant. You're like, oh my gosh, that's awesome. And they're really good at their job because, you know, they kind of bring something different to the table. Same thing with production. I think I work with some awesome male producers, and you definitely see that they handle jobs differently than you, not necessarily because they're a man maybe, but it's just a different perspective, I think. And it's kind of nice to see more men in that field. And same goes the other way, seeing more female artists in those seats. It's awesome.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, and that's one of the things that at School of Motion, we really have tried to like push and try to raise awareness to help get more female artists into the industry. You know, and I think it's just one of these like holdovers from like an earlier time. There's just like a lot of unconscious bias still kicking around, and it's starting to go away. So as far as like male, female producers, like, you know, I think in the end, because I've worked with a lot of both, and in the end, it doesn't matter if it's male or female. Are they a good producer? So I'm curious what you think makes a good producer. And actually, before you answer that, tell me what makes a bad producer.
So I think, you know, like, you said there's, you know, this bias. It's kind of like, maybe it's just a field that a lot of men decided to go into, or a lot of women decided to go into more so than others. Just like, you know, plumbers or, you know, construction workers or dental hygienists, just sometimes some roles, just certain, you know, male or females are drawn to different roles and different types of, you know, work than others. And so regardless of why that is, as long as you are doing it well and you enjoy it, then that's fine. It's nice to see a shift because some, you know, like I said, it's refreshing to see female artists and male producers and sort of see that paradigm shift. But at the same time, I don't think it's, you need to force it. I don't think you need to, you know, force that on certain companies or industries. Just let it happen sort of organically, and it is, which is cool. In terms of being a good or bad producer, I think it's hard to say what makes a bad producer because it's so hard. It's such a hard job. So, you know, if a producer's in a role where they aren't doing such a great job, or they're not getting along with their artists, or that they're pissing clients off, I think that's just because it's a hard job to do, and that person might just not be cut out for it and to taking on those roles, taking on those responsibilities. That I think the reason for that is, you know, maybe they're not good communicators. Maybe they're not able to humble themselves and ask the right questions and ask, you know, sort of try to inform themselves. Maybe they think they know it all and they don't need to check in with the artists, or they feel like they can just stand up to the client without having any real knowledge on what something's going to take to do. So I think it's just a personality thing. If you're a good producer, that's probably because you have put the time in to like humble yourself and ask the right questions and learn from other people and sort of take on sort of have someone mentor you and learn from someone and get yourself, you know, as much knowledge as possible about the industry, about, you know, brands and client and doing sort of like legwork on your own. I think it comes down to a personality thing. You're either, you know, if you're good or you're bad at it, it's because the person you are.
Interesting. So what I'll add to that. So I think you said, you know, communication, personality. I mean, those clearly are like incredibly important. One of the things that I've noticed with the best producers I've worked with is how they deal with stressful situations is different than the way a lot of artists do, right? So like I've been at studios where there's 10 people working on some big project and we show the client the first round and they just crap all over it and everyone's freaking out and, oh my God, the sky's falling, the client's gonna leave and none of us will ever work again. And the producer's the rock in the storm. You know, they're not freaking out. They're like, ah, all right, no big deal. So let's fix this, right? And they're kind of the level-headed person in the room. So I'm curious if you agree with that. And if you do, like, how do you maintain that when, in fact, like, some bad news has just been given to the artists? You know, they're going to have to work harder and the client didn't like what they did.
Yeah, that's their job. You know, their job is to keep everyone sort of afloat and without having them see their legs kind of like scrambling underwater. They're supposed to be sort of like the beacon of light for everybody and the positive, give out positive vibes and remind people that, you know, this job is a really cool project. It's a good opportunity. We just got to keep focused and do, you know, as much as we can to make it, you know, be as proud as we can of it and have our client be as happy as they are. It's just constantly reinforcing that. I think, again, it comes down to a personality. If you are a level-headed person to begin with and a good multitasker and a good communicator, then you're going to be a good producer and be able to continue to stay level-headed during certain situations like that.
So inside you're like terrified, but like on the outside, you're like, don't worry, I got this.
Yes, exactly. So that's, you know, that's sort of what the crux of production is really learning how to manage all these different things that are thrown at you, but also, you know, keeping a good smile on your face and doing, you know, doing it as calmly so that your team doesn't freak out and your client doesn't freak out too, because sometimes your client will call in a panic and say, oh my gosh, we need to get this by 2 p.m. And you can go back to them and be like, well, is it okay if we get it by 4? Because we don't want to give you a crappy product just because you need it by 2. And it's just kind of helping them, get through the choppy waters as well.
Gotcha. So let's talk about your role in actually like putting teams together that are going to be working on these projects. So like as a producer, are you involved in sort of deciding which artists are actually going to be on a particular project?
Yeah, I think you have an idea of what the project entails, you know, and you have an idea of who would be best suited for it. It comes down to scheduling too, who's available. Smaller shops where, you know, you maybe have to, staff up with freelancers, you kind of know who might be good, who might be bad, people who, you know, maybe artists have someone they've worked with in the past that they said, you know, would be perfect for this job. So you reach out to them, check out their reels. I think, like I said, having knowledge of, you know, what's good and what's bad design and good and bad comp and visual effects helps as a producer because you get to then decide, you know, who's best suited for your job. So you definitely have a say. It's a company like The Mill. It also comes down to scheduling and availability. So you try to put the best person, the best team on the job, but we have so many jobs that warrant the best people and the best, you know, person on the job that at the same time, that sometimes your ideal person isn't available. So then maybe instead of having, you know, Sam, you have Joe and Katie, because Joe and Katie may be a little bit more junior, but together they could be, you know, really great. So it's just kind of learning how to work with different people and moving the different pieces around so you get the ideal team for the job.
Gotcha. And does The Mill, you know, the Mill has a pretty big talent pool internally, but does The Mill also hire a lot of freelancers?
We do at times. Again, it just depends, you know, on if the job warrants someone that has a specialty that maybe we don't have on staff or isn't available, then we'll bring someone in. Chicago's interesting market because there's a lot of freelancers in town and in certain specialties like, you know, motion graphics and design, but there's not a lot of just CG and comp artists sitting around Chicago. So those are really hard to come by. Generally, we'll pull resources from other offices if they're available. If not, then we'll try to fly artists in from other places. Or, you know, if someone's available in town, then we'll bring them in as well. So it just depends on the job and how many projects we have in-house and our in-house staff, what they're booked on and their availability.
Sure. And you've worked at other shops where I'm sure there was, you know, maybe a higher percentage of freelancers coming in the door.
Yeah.
So when you're in a position where you have to hire a freelancer, what is like the most important thing to you? Is it talent? Is it like their reel is the best reel? Or is like a relationship that you have with them more important, their reliability? Like, what do you consider before you hire a freelancer?
Here in town, I definitely, or even outside of town, you know, I'll definitely consider, past jobs that I've done with people and how well we've worked together and their experience. I think that says a lot more than just someone's reel. Cause someone's reel could be, you know, super specialized in like, you know, just motion graphics and design, but maybe I know that this person has a really good eye for concept development or, you know, hand-drawn illustration that's not on his reel. So having the experience of having worked with some people, really helps. And I think that says a lot more than, you know, what sometimes is, displayed on their reels. When you're working with new freelancers, then yes, a reel definitely helps. Breakdowns help, behind the scenes help. And you know, knowing what they did specifically on a job instead of just showing the spot is really key too.
Yeah. So you mentioned breakdowns, and that's one of the things I always tell everybody they should be doing. And I'm curious why having a breakdown of like a project you did would help you, you know, be more comfortable hiring them.
It helps because it does two things in terms of like a comp artist or, you know, a more senior visual effects artist. It kind of shows their work process and their mentality. So, you know, you can see sort of how they approach a certain job and what it took to actually do it. For like a designer, motion graphics artist, it's a little bit more difficult because it's more, you know, singular layers, but it helps because you do show like, you know, what maybe the initial board was, what their style frame was, and then what their final, you know, motion piece was. So it shows sort of their creative process as well.
Gotcha. So it's more about like giving you a comfort level in terms of like what they're actually able to do as opposed to, oh, well, it's on their reel, but it's possible that it's on their reel and they were part of a team and that job looks great in spite of them working on
right.
it.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Gotcha. So so let's pretend that I'm brand new to the industry and I've got a decent reel and I want the mill to consider me for a freelancer. Like, what's the best way to, you know, get on Erica's radar so that maybe she'll consider me for another project?
I love looking at artists' reels and I love like sharing them with the different, you know, artists we have at the shop, just kind of get their take on it. That kind of helps me, educate me and like, you know, what's kind of continually to be good and bad, you know, comp design, motion graphics and visual effects. And just kind of starts a conversation. Oh, this is a cool spot. Or, maybe this guy worked with somebody in the office before at like Motion Theory in LA or something like that. So it's kind of nice to pass those around and kind of chit chat about people's reels. I think the best way to, you know, kind of get your foot in the door at certain shops like that is to freelance at multiple places so that you do get your name out there and you get sort of good press. That way, you know, we're not only looking for you at your, you know, looking at you for your reel, but also for your experience with other places and potentially other artists that have worked with you in the past. And then we have, you know, we have an awesome team of talent managers that can kind of invite you to come in and sit down and chat with you and tell you kind of what we're doing, talk about the market and what we're hoping, you know, to like what areas we're kind of hoping to grow in, and just kind of give you honest feedback on everything. Every now and then, sometimes we get the opportunity to have someone come in and sit down with the creative director or a lead artist and talk about, you know, what you've been up to, what we're up to, and just have like a kind of a conversation to get to know you better. Such a personality thing too, you know. The culture at the mill is just that everybody generally likes who we all work with. And that really helps when, you know, you're forming sort of this team structure and you have each other's backs because you generally like people and you respect what they do and respect them as an artist. So I think the big thing is just kind of getting as much experience at different shops all over the place to get your name out there and then coming in, you know, through the talent managers and getting in to chat with them.
Got it. So the mill is I guess sort of unique in that it's a really big shop and you have talent managers. I think that's the fact that you have talent managers sets it apart. So like for the mill, you know, would you recommend someone contact the talent manager or if they can, you know, if they you know, listen to this podcast and they get your email address to send you their reel, like, would that turn you off? Or like, would you rather they go through the official channels? Like, how, you know, how do you prefer to like learn about a new freelance artist?
You know, a place like The Mill, it definitely needs to go through different sort of levels of review before bringing someone in, and then, you know, kind of getting them on board with the scheduling team and making sure the creative directors are on board with bringing them on. So having me, you know, send a, but also I have experience, you know, in hiring freelancers and working with them directly. So if I know I've worked with somebody and I'm going to pass their info on to scheduling or to the talent manager or creative director, I think that says something. But if I don't know you and you just forward me a reel, I'm just going to forward it on to a talent manager and maybe give my opinion, but it still has to go through so many different levels, you know, of a review. But I think, you know, and I'm sure The Mill gets inundated with reels and, you know, resumes and all that, but I think it's, unless you have, you know, someone, unless you've worked at another shop with another freelancer who can then go to The Mill and say, oh yeah, I worked with this guy, definitely bring him in for a trial, or, you know, bring him in for this quick little job and try him out. That's, I think, the best way, is just sort of word of mouth. It's such a surprisingly small community, you know, it's like huge, but at the same time small, because everyone sort of knows everybody through some sort of, you know, 3 degrees of Kevin Bacon.
Exactly. 3 degrees of Ryan Honey or something. Yeah, it's true.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, so like if someone's brand new to the industry, what are some things you've seen that are kind of rookie moves? Like, ooh, I wish they didn't put that in their email to me. Now it doesn't even matter what their reel looks like, you know? Are there any things like that that have popped up?
I think the few times when they call themselves art directors or or creative directors, and they're like, you know, straight out of SCAD or something, and you're like, okay.
Gotcha. So be humble, I guess, is the...
Yeah, and you know what's funny is you generally don't get those types of emails or people in this industry. I mean, you do, you'll get the few, but in motion graphics and design, I think everyone kind of knows how to play the game and walk the walk. And I think another cool thing is to kind of be involved in like, in things like, you know, like your, you know, School of Motion and the blogs and Grayscale Gorilla and that sort of thing, because it kind of opens your, you know, your world to, opens your, you to a different world, and you get to meet different people, and those people know people. So it's just kind of expanding your network that way.
Right. I mean, relationships are still everything, even in this business, where, because to me, like, you know, motion design specifically, it's like it is very much a meritocracy. Like, you can put a reel together that shows what you can do, and if you're awesome, people will hire you. I mean, it's like, it's, they don't really care what your degree was. I mean, obviously, you know, like, we have film and television degrees. Like, who would hire us? You know, and so I think that, like, people need to realize that, like, you know, it's talent and then it's relationships. And I've seen that time and time again. So let me ask you this. This is a question I know everyone's wondering. What sort of rates, and you can kind of give a range with, like, examples, like, what sort of rates does The Mill pay freelancers?
I have no idea. It's nice to be removed from all that stuff, finally being at The Mill. My buddies of mine who've been freelancing or leave companies to go freelance have definitely, you know, asked, what should I charge for a day rate? And it's kind of hard to say, because it depends, like I said, on your level of expertise, on what skill sets you have. Are you just After Effects? Are you After Effects in Cinema 4D? Are you Nuke? Are you, you know, Houdini? And I think there's probably a standard rate for everything nowadays, because there's so much, you know, so much out there that you probably can't charge much more than what someone else is already charging, I imagine. When, you know, we're considering freelancers, I know we consider rates, and sometimes someone's a little bit higher than others, and we'll bring them on because we know that they'll do a great job, unsupervised, go with the job and just run with it. So maybe they're a little more, but we bring them on because we know that we can trust them. But I don't know what those rates are really lately. It's just been, I think it's better just to talk amongst different artists and see what everyone's charging, because I think there's definitely a standard.
Interesting. So at other studios where maybe there was more freelancers, were you involved in like rate discussions with freelancers, or has it always been sort of someone else's, you know, problem to worry about.
No, when I was hiring freelancers directly, I definitely had to talk about rates and negotiate rates. The thing with rates is you shouldn't have to negotiate the rate for an artist. You know, I think that's, like I said, I think there should be like more standard rates for a certain After Effects artist or After Effects instant properties should be this rate. It shouldn't be like, one guy's 700 and one guy's 350. It's like, well, I'm going to hire the guy with 350 unless the guy with 700 is going to blow me away and be able to, like, you know, take a job to another level. But sometimes all you need is an After Effects artist just to put together, you know, some moving supers. So you're going to hire the guy for 350. But sometimes you need someone to kind of run with the project and sort of art direct the project. So maybe you'll go for the guy that charges 700 a day. But I don't think it's possible as a freelancer to have such a huge range and, in rate. So the guy, when I asked the guy who charges 700, hey, will you do this job for 350? And he says, yes. I think that's going to be like kind of raise a red flag for me and be like, well, if you're taking this job out for 350, then why are you charging 700 originally? So I have been involved, you know, directly with artists and dealing with their rates, but, that's where I've sort of seen that it's usually the same. Everyone's rates are kind of within, you know, $50, $75 of each other.
That's really interesting. Yeah. So we did a survey about a year and a half ago and asked a lot of producers and creative directors, hiring people, about rates. And that was one of the things we kept getting was that rates kind of are all over the place and don't match up as well as they should with the actual experience level of the artist.
Yeah.
You have students right out of school with 25-second reels of student work trying to charge $700 a day. And then you have these amazing 3D artists charging $250 a day,
yeah,
just because they don't realize what they're actually worth. And there isn't like a great way. And I can speak as an artist. I mean, as an artist, there's not really an easy way to know what rate to charge other than to ask.
You know? Interesting. Is it not like discussed at school at all? Like what rates general, like the going rates are for certain artists? Like do people just come out of school and say, all right, I'm going to charge 100 because that's what I feel like I'm worth? Or is that what they're told to charge?
So all I can speak about is from my personal experience. So for me coming out of school, I had no idea that freelancing was even a thing.
Mm-hmm.
It just wasn't on my radar. And so the way I learned about rates was by asking another freelancer that I knew what I should
charge. Yeah.
And it's interesting because the rates that I charged when I started freelancing, like, I don't know, 10 years ago or longer now, Jesus, they haven't really changed. My rate, I'll just say it. So my rate when I started freelancing was $500 a day. As an After Effects artist who could also edit.
Mm-hmm.
And then by the time I was, you know, finished with my freelancing career, I could edit, I could design, I could animate. I also knew 3D and Nuke and could composite. So I was like a good B-plus level at all of those things. Like,
yeah.
I don't know if the mill would have hired me. But I was like good enough at all those things where I was charging $700 a day and getting it consistently. And I was also able to like lead projects and things like that. So that was kind of the range, and from what I've heard from people, that's still pretty much the range. But on the lower end, I mean, if I was starting out now, like right out of school, I'd probably only charge maybe $350 a day.
Yeah.
But there's so many variables, right? Like if you're in New York, $500 a day is nothing. Like, you know, no studio will even blink at that. But if you're in, I don't know, Topeka or something, then that might be a really high rate. So it's tricky, and people are kind of shy talking about money, I think.
Yeah. Well, that's why I'm shocked that it's not discussed in school, like what rates, you know, are usually set at. And I think, you know, when you mentioned you were charging $700 for a day rate because, you know, you could do all these things at a B plus level, someone who's really, really good at, you know, at Nuke could charge $700 and they just do Nuke.
Right.
So it just depends like on the market and how you're trying to market yourself. If you're trying to market yourself as an all in type of person that can do a job start to finish, then yeah, charge that. But I think it's really wise for freelancers to sort of like specialize in one thing and do that one thing really, really well. And that would warrant a higher rate because you do that one skill set really, really well. You know, you're really good at Houdini or you're really good at, you know, at Nuke, as opposed to, oh yeah, I dabble in Houdini and I also know a little bit of Nuke and I also know a little bit of Cinema 4D. So since I know all these things, I can do all of them, I'm going to charge $700. I don't think that person's going to get hired at a place like the Mill versus, you know, someone who does Cinema 4D really, really well.
Exactly. Yeah. I agree with you. I think that the jack of all trades is going to get booked all the time by, like, if you're a B plus artist, you're going to get booked by B plus clients. You know? I mean, that's just
or direct to clients, kind of internal type of places.
Yeah. And that's just reality. If you want to work at the Mill, which is an A plus place, you have to be an A plus artist. And the odds of being A plus at all of those things are close to zero.
Right.
So specialized. And I guess from what you say, the Mill needs more Nuke compositors and maybe Houdini people. So move to Chicago, get really good at Nuke.
I mean, it's like learn Nuke, people. We need Nuke artists.
That's awesome. All right. Nuke Boot Camp coming soon from School of Motion. Awesome.
Totally.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, Erica, this has been amazing and we kind of went all over the place, but I think you gave a lot of really good advice. So, I want to just close with, is there any advice you would give to people who listen to this and say, you know what? I love this industry. I love creative work. I feel like producing might be a great fit for me. What would you tell them in terms of like how to prepare themselves and actually go out and find work as a producer?
I think the biggest thing to do if you are interested in sort of producing in this field is to get in from the ground up and really learn how not only like a certain business works, but how the whole industry works and the pipeline works. Because that's the only way you're going to get knowledgeable is by getting in and doing. You know, you can't go to producer school. So you need to get into a company, whether it's an internship or a runner position or an entry-level associate coordinator position, whatever, and get in, get, you know, some mentors and just start to learn the industry and the pipeline. I think in working at as many different places as possible, like I was kind of fortunate to do, is great too, because then you learn how different places work and you can bring different, knowledge, levels of knowledge and expertise to different places to a shop. There's, like I said, there's no real like easy way to get in except for, you know, taking that entry level position and just really learning how to work with so many different types of people and personalities. I always say that, you know, my skill set of learning to work with so many different people comes from like working in the food and beverage industry, like bartending and waitressing, because you work with so many different crazy personalities that, you know, walking into production is just like a walk in the park.
So step one is go work at a bar for a little while.
Step one is go look at Chili's straight out of college.
Very nice. Very nice. Awesome. And you know, on that note, like you mentioned, like having some sort of mentor. I mean, producers don't really get the credit in the press that the artists do, right? They don't get the accolades the same way, right? And so I would even suggest like reach out to producers because and you can answer this better than I could, but I would imagine producers would probably be overjoyed to hear that, like, oh, you're interested in what I do. I'll definitely tell you anything if you have questions. Would you recommend reaching out to producers if you have questions or just for
guides? I think it's really good. I've always enjoyed at different places that I've worked at, being involved in the hiring of interns and hiring of staff. I love sitting down and talking with people and getting to know, you know, what their interests are and giving them a little bit of insight into what we do and maybe how to go about, you know, getting to that next step. And as a producer, you know, you are generally a personable person and good communicator and you like to talk. So it's always a good idea to kind of reach out to them and even just meet for coffee or lunch or come in for a quick meeting and talk about what we do and see if it's for you. I mean, just recently we interviewed somebody who was going to be hired on as a coordinator and, you know, seemed very excited about the position, didn't really have a lot of maybe background or experience in the field, but seemed very eager to learn. And then 2 weeks into the job decided that it wasn't for her because it was, you know, it wasn't what she expected. So maybe if she had kind of taken the time to actually like sit and shadow someone or see, you know, what it actually takes and talk to a couple different producers, a couple different companies, she might've realized that ahead of time.
That's awesome. That's really good advice. Well, Erica, thank you. It was so awesome to talk with you and catch up with you. And I hope everyone listening, like, you know, learned a lot about what it is to be a producer and maybe is producing something they're interested in. I just want to say thank you. And I hope we can do this again.
Yeah. Thank you for having me. It's been great chatting and getting to catch up with you and hearing all the questions that people might have, it's kind of gives me a little bit of insight into what I do and how I can maybe help other people.
Awesome. Awesome. All right. Well, we'll be looking out for more from you from the mill.
Great. Thanks, Joey.
Here's a fun fact about Erica. Her maiden name is Wrangle, and she's a producer. Get it? I'm sure that's the first time she's heard that joke. Anyway, I hope you learned a ton from this interview about, you know, how a bigger studio like The Mill works and the role of producers in the industry, and maybe even some tips you can apply to your own career. Thank you so much for listening, and please share this episode if you dug it. It means a lot to us, and it helps us spread the word about School of Motion, which, of course, we'd love. I love you all, and I will catch you on the next one.